Welcome to Mkhwazi Unfiltered. As you all know, this is the podcast that brings you Zambia's movers and shakers. But we get to chat with them about stuff that they don't regularly talk about. Today is yet another episode where we'll have a conversation with one of Zambia's finest. And we're excited to have this conversation. My name is Khamisa Chikula and I'm going to be your host for this podcast. Today's guest is a man who needs no introduction because he's a man who's constantly on camera, doing lots of work in the public sector. He's a man who has had a challenge, which he navigated really well in the sense that he was looking after the DMMU at a time when Zambia faced one of its worst droughts ever. He's a man who's an academician. He's a man who loves to read. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a time that I have not found him doing any sort of study to better and improve himself. He holds a PhD, he's an economist, he's a man of many talents, and today we'll discover some of the secrets behind his success and also what drives and motivates him. So without further ado, please welcome to Mkhwazi Unfiltered our guest for this episode, Dr. Gabriel Pollen. Welcome, Gabriel.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
It is good to have you
here. Quite an introduction.
Yeah, no. I mean, I cut it short, actually. We would still be going if I had followed the script. How are things going?
No, things are good. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have wonderful individuals such as yourself. We just need to dig deep and start right at the beginning. Tell us about your childhood and that one vivid memory that still feels like home.
Basically, mom and dad had four boys. So I'm the third of the four boys. Obviously, grew up with my brothers, who are now all over the world today. Here in Zambia. And, you know, growing up was quite an amazing experience. I mean, as it is for most people. I think importantly, being the third born in a family of four boys, I learned a lot from my older brothers, their interactions, their music, their style. That influenced me quite a bit. And, you know, you always look up to your older siblings.
Right.
So that's also true for me as well. You know, grew up in different parts of Lusaka. Born in Lusaka.
Ah, there we go. LSK. Representing.
Grew up in different parts. I lived just down the road in Kalundu.
Lived
in Long Acres. Lived in Kabwata most of my life.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Awesome. And if your parents were to describe you, how do you think they'll describe you as a child?
That's an interesting
one. That laugh says a lot.
That's an interesting one. They would probably give different answers at different points in time.
So
they would probably say something like, oh, Gabriel, between 1 and 10 was this type of character.
Right.
Because I think I have morphed, I've evolved over time. Mm. So they wouldn't necessarily give one answer. But one thing they would probably say is that, you know, I was always very focused on school, always dedicated. My dad had this rule where he would reward any one of us if we passed between number 1 and 3.
Oh, wow.
And I made it the points to always be number 1.
Explains the competitiveness.
it's quite a very strict rule. Looking back, but it really, really helped me to stay focused and you know, recognize the competitive nature of our existence.
And looking back at that, who would you say had the biggest influence in your life? And what is that lesson that they taught you that you've kept to this day?
I know this might sound cliche.
Yes.
But it is my dad.
He's
a very, very religious, devoted man. Very, very disciplined, and I think everybody else who may have spent time with him would tell you what type of an individual he was. Very, very honest in his trade and craft, and really has imparted very sound values in me, I think, that I carry on, and hopefully my kids can also pick up on. Issues around, obviously, the soft skills in social networking, honesty, you know. Be a man of your words. When you say something, mean it and, you know, deliver. Be committed at your post of duty. When you show up for work, be in the best behavior and do the most that you can. Yeah, so, you know, he has been quite impactful in that sense, but also the Christian values that I grew up under. can be credited solely to him. He was a disciplinarian in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, with four boys, you've got to be a disciplinarian. Any soft hand with four boys, and you're asking for trouble. That's havoc.
Indeed.
So you've got to be firm. And what did he do for a living?
He used to work for Nippon Motors.
Ah.
And I think he used to live in Dole at some point in time, and he used to work for some engineering company that used to supply to the mines, I think, and then moved to Lusaka, where...
Right.
Where he had me with him, obviously.
Yes.
he used to work for Nippon Motors. It was Star Motors. It was Nippon Motors and became Star Motors before it became Toyota Zambia.
Yes.
So by the time that he was leaving, it was Toyota Zambia that time. But I was driving past there recently at the show Sifao.
Right.
Or something like that.
Farm Ability.
He was in clearing and forwarding and freight and insurance.
Wow.
And I think at the time of his retirement, he was like a manager or something like that.
Amazing.
A very, very dedicated fellow, I should say, to work and duty.
You just put in like the effort. And obviously, they say children learn from what they see as opposed to what they hear. And obviously, you saw his work ethic and that must have impacted you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. So my aunt, when she traveled to England, she came back with the gifts. She always gave us gifts.
Right.
During Christmas. So one of them was Jack and the Beanstalk.
Ah.
So that was one of my early sort of initiation, so to speak, in terms of, you know, developing that reading culture.
Mm.
So every time my dad came back from work, he'd be like, Beanstalk, have you read Jack and the Beanstalk? Like, yeah, yes, I have. So in the early days, I'd memorize literally before I could understand. But over time, you appreciate that, you know, that type of culture of reading is not natural. It's something that you have to cultivate and nurture.
Build it, yes.
Nurture in your kids and create a routine around it. And obviously those days it felt like trouble. Like, you know, why is he giving me this much?
Why are you bothering me?
Why is he giving me this much script? But, you know, come from where? Beanstalk. What page are you on? And I'd be like, oh, okay, wow. I'm on this page now. So Jack now has gone up the beanstalk. He's by the giants,
giants castle.
And so I remember that story very well. Yeah.
Embedded. Yep. Speaking of stories, is there any particular story that you go back to and it always elicits a bit of a laugh when you remember, especially in school, be it primary or secondary school? An incident or something that just puts a smile on your face when you remember it?
Yes, actually. So during, I think during primary school, actually happened. It was a disciplinarian, my dad, like I said.
Yeah.
So during primary school, actually, me and my friends, we got naughty because I started school just next to Lisef.
Right.
School again. I forgot the name.
Lotus.
Lotus, yes. Yes. I started from Lotus. No, I started from Roma, just down the road here by Zambezi, by Roma, by the church.
Really? My goodness.
Yes.
the nursery school there.
Yeah, absolutely. And in grade one, I did a little bit of Lotus. So Lotus there, we... First day at school.
Oh, right? No.
So don't judge me on that.
No, so don't judge.
First day at school, met up a couple of friends. I mean, I was a pretty small guy, probably the youngest. So I was, I think, 19. That's 1988, I think.
Hmm.
It's not too long ago.
Just a couple
of years ago, 1988. First day at school, we with friends of mine, well, I just made friends there.
Yeah.
We went into the school maze field, and the guys are like, oh, this maze is for us, you know, you could get it.
Wow.
And then I picked out a cob, and then everyone started laughing at me, and they ran away.
Oh no.
So I went with the maze cob. I put it in my bag, went with it home, and my dad came back and is like, what did you do? So he gave me some money to go to take to the head teacher.
Right.
So instead of giving the head teacher the money, I went to go and buy a donut.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see where this is going.
My brother always laughed at me, like, just as though he didn't turn out to be that type of a person. Because over time, obviously, but I mean, it's an interesting experience, first of all, in the sense that I broke the rule on the first day of class.
Right.
And just as a young boy, didn't do what my dad asked me to do.
Wow.
So I had a little bit of that.
How did the discipline go?
Oh, no. I was terribly disciplined, so to speak.
You had a character-building conversation.
I was terribly disciplined. It's not that the kids of today.
No.
You have to sit down and talk to. The belt would do its job.
Oh, right? Yes. Yes, the belt was well used. In terms of upbringing, I mean, we always get influenced by our friends and the people that we see around us, our peers. In what way did you see a difference in the way you were brought up that impacted who you are today?
So I grew up pretty much a church boy and a little bit of a nerd, so to speak, in the sense that, you know, I friends would be relaxing over the weekend and I'd be going out to the library to read. And I think I found myself when I went to uni 25 years ago, at the University of Zambia, went and interacted with different people from all walks of life. I think had a broader sort of perspective about life and living. And it's during that time that I formed friendships that I've carried on to today. So a quarter of a century is not a very short time, so to speak, to have formed friendships, but also to appreciate that, you know, there's a lot of diversity and variety in the way in which we grow up.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of people that had different socialization processes, but we all merged in this place, you know, at the university itself to, you know, give out ourselves in a way that helped us form the kinds of humans that we are today. And ultimately, you see from those interactions, you form long-lasting friendships. Sometimes some of those friendships drop out. Some of them become acquaintances.
Right.
But you learn quite a lot. But prior to going to the University of Zambia, you know, my dad had this really good colleague of his who was a churchmate, so I really admired him.
Right.
And he had done economics at the University of Zambia. So I was like, oh, maybe I should do economics. Because growing up, I thought I'd be a medical doctor. But I think just last minute, I changed my mind. I said, you know what, I'm going to pursue economics. I think I didn't make a mistake.
Found your feet. So It's interesting that there are people that we look up to, and in some cases, they don't even know that they are heroes.
Absolutely.
And they've formed so much impact within us that it directs the path of our lives thereafter. Did you ever get to tell them that he was your inspiration?
I think I did. I think I did in many ways, because I've had a conversation with him to say, well, we actually, my inspiration for doing economics, I really, really admired. I mean, he works for the United Nations now. He's a big boss somewhere in Africa, and he's done quite well for himself. I think he's aging towards retirement now. But he really did inspire me to pursue a degree in economics and to understand what the economy was all about. At that time, I really had no understanding what economics was.
Right.
I think you learn by doing, you learn by being in class, and as you rummage through the books and the material, you get to understand what the subject matter is all about.
Right. Now, you've had a very varied career, from academics, in fact, from banking into academics and then into public service. Now, these are some major pivots. And this is, you don't really see a straight line. It's almost as if you went to one spot, then swung across to the other. Were these pivots intentional, or did fate just play its hand?
I think a combination, actually. There were some parts of my career trajectory that were intentional, the academic part, for example.
Right.
And then there are certain things that happened as a result of fate, I guess, and public service being one of them.
Right.
I completed my undergraduate studies at the University of Zambia in 2004, in December. I was one of the best performing students in the economics faculty. So I stayed on as a tutor, teaching assistant at the University of Zambia, helping out with undergraduate students. So I think that was pretty intentional. And I really wanted to do a master's degree.
Right.
So Professor Maninga Dulo, very, very renowned economist in Zambia, everyone who's done economics at UNSA over the past 4 or 5 decades knows who this man is.
That is true.
Charming figure. We were part of the African Economic Research Consortium, which is basically a consortium of economic faculties in Africa where they were trying to promote regional training. So in 2006, I went to Addis Ababa, where I went to do my master's, and everybody got surprised, like, why would you go to Ethiopia to do your master's? But it's an interesting experience to study within Africa, another African setting.
Right.
Came back in 2008 and immediately became a lecturer at the University of Zambia from 2008. And in 2012, 2013, went for my PhD. So the academic trajectory around that time was pretty much intentional.
Right.
Intentional in the sense that I really wanted to flourish in the academic space.
Right.
I wanted
right.
to consume as much material economics yeah. as I could. And I could only do that within the context of an academic space. Then went to the UK to pursue a PhD in economics at the University of London, SOAS,
right.
Which was also quite an interesting experience because during my PhD studies, I taught at the University of Huddersfield, taught master students, taught undergraduate students. And my latest visit, the UK, actually, I was hanging out with some of my old students.
Right.
One of them has actually developed a fitness app.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that can track your macros and can make recommendations for calories and so forth. So to impact
right.
people in that way, and you know they recognize and you've been away for that long and you can come back and interact in that space. That was quite intentional. Then I came back to Zambia 2018.
Right.
Now back at the University of Zambia. Then I went into, I used to also teach at the University of Lusaka. I helped
right.
with the development of curriculum in the economics faculty as well.
Right.
And I joined the civil society space, or let's just say research think tank with the Center for Trade Policy and Development as a senior researcher for public finance. Around that time, I also joined First Capital Bank as an in-house economist.
Economist, right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So First Capital Bank. So like I said, networks are important. One of my odd friends from the University of Zambia, who was a year behind us and was roommates, a very close friend of mine
right.
for First Capital Bank, senior management. And he reached out to me as an academic. Hey, Gabriel, would you like to do a feature? We're doing something on the Zambian economy and want to talk to our clients. And I was looking for somebody to do a presentation.
Like, yeah, right. yeah,
I'm game. I mean, this is my field. Get a presentation. The MD really liked the presentation. Like, hey, can we hold on to you a little bit longer? So they offered me a position as a consulting economist for
right.
the bank.
Right.
So whilst I was doing that as well, I also got like a consultancy with UNICEF.
Right.
Long term. So
right.
at the time of my appointment in December 2021, I literally had five jobs.
Oh, wow.
I was juggling. Literally
Where did you find the time, though?
Literally had five jobs that I was juggling. And that's quite interesting. I think that also, in a way, reflects the resilience, I think, within me.
Right.
And also passion to just learn as much as I can in different fields
right.
and apply myself and, you know, just... enhance my capacity, but
yeah.
I did what I had to do and continued to do that.
from what I hear, it sounds like you never back down from a challenge.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's always challenge accepted.
Absolutely.
Challenge accepted.
I like to challenge myself. I like to challenge myself quite a bit. I like routine, but I like spontaneity sometimes. I think routine is important. It builds discipline and character.
Right.
And we know what atomic habits do over time, they compound
right. Right.
to create the kind of results that we anticipate. But spontaneity also is also important because it adds a flavor of randomness
Correct.
To our existence.
Correct.
And that really is
breaks the routine.
Spice. Absolutely. That
yeah.
is the spice of our living.
Now, it is said, and I subscribe to this, that for any individual who's successful, there's an element of them being able to talk to themselves and will themselves across the finish line. Now, when pressure mounts, what do you think is your go-to mantra? Is it one of those where you just say, sleep can wait, or I will not fail? What do you say to yourself to hype yourself and to push yeah. yourself across the finish line?
Yeah, that's absolutely good. I mean, I've sacrificed sleep so many times.
It's a luxury.
So, absolutely, sacrificed sleep so many times. And even today, in my current placement, in my current position as Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Local Government, people at the office will tell you, and also at DMMU, they'll tell you that I'll probably be the first person to get to the office. The one time I got the office, really, really pretty early. I won't say what time it was, but the sun hadn't come out yet. And it's one of those times when we had long days.
Right.
And short nights, but the sun wasn't out yet, but I was in the office. And one of the guards was like, I've never seen anyone come this early. I was like, I've got deadlines to beat.
Right.
So I'm that type of a person who will shift my schedule around, stretch the 24-hour period to 30 to 40 hours in order to accomplish a particular task. So I will come blazing with my guns just to make sure that I get something done. So I'm that type of a person.
One thing I keep hearing every time I have a conversation with anyone who knows you or who had the misfortune of being lectured by you, he's he was a savage. No, he just enjoyed making us suffer. I mean, you'd put in the work, you'd study, and you're like, yeah, this is it. This is the assignment. And it comes back in and you're like, you're staring at a sea and like, how?
That's true.
Was this an attempt to push people beyond their limits or to make them better?
So first of all, I'll answer that by saying that they actually evolved also as an academic. In my early days as an academic, it was really about trying to push people to the limits and getting the most out of them. And I did that in the early stages of my academic career.
Right.
Some of the guys that I taught now have PhDs around that time, and they appreciate, like, oh, this guy really grilled us.
Yeah.
But at the time of the grilling, obviously, it wasn't fun.
It wasn't any fun.
But then I think when I got my PhD and came back, I think that really, really humbled me. Because during the PhD study, I realized how little I understood about the subject matter of economics.
Oh, wow.
And that really, really humbled me. And then also met different people from other parts of the world as well that converged in London. And I came back a much more humane academic, so to speak.
The humbling had done its part.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I came back that time, you can see the master students I taught that time, I was very gentle. And I think my approach also changed because I was more interested in trying to help people understand critique and build their critical thinking as opposed to recollection of the material and regurgitation people's ideas and that kind of stuff.
Because anyone can do that.
Absolutely.
But can a person internalize it and then apply it and present it based on what they've actually learned?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well played. Now, learning's continue in our lives. During your professional career, what is the one moment where you look back and say, aha, I like that moment?
I think it was during my PhD studies, actually.
Right.
So fundamentally, the way the PhD is scheduled is that you get admitted to your PhD program, but the first year of PhD study, you're working towards what they call an upgrade,
right,
where they'll determine whether or not your material is PhD worthy,
right,
or whether they could just push you into an MPhil course. So when I did my presentation, I think that was around February 2014, I did my PhD upgrade around that time. That time people didn't even know me. You know, you'd interact with different people. But after the presentation, people came up to me and I'm like, oh wow, that was brilliant. And I met some friends who remain friends now, very, very, very smart guys. But it was one of those moments that really put me on the world stage and made me really happy to recognize that, I was worthy of the material that would be recognized at international platform. So that was really, really good. But also I appreciate my PhD supervisor, Professor Ben Fine. I think he's one of those guys that really, really helped me to think critically, and is one of the few individuals that really helped to humble me.
Right.
Because I realized how well-read it was, and yet how well-grounded it was as a human being,
right,
and not just an academic. Right. I mean, thousands and thousands of publications, but the guy would, just relate with you.
Just a well-balanced individual.
Very, very well-balanced.
Right. Individual.
So always, he also changed the way in which I approached my teaching profession as well, and also the way I relate with people professionally, like try to see the good in them and try to build people up as opposed to tearing them down.
Right. And I know for a fact that any person who has any measure of success in their life has had failures. Which failure stands out for you, and what did you learn from it? How did you overcome it? How did you use that as super fuel to catapult you to the next level?
That's an interesting question. Just trying to think through it. Failure. I'm not perfect.
By no means.
I have not had a straightforward sort of straight line career path. But to say that I've encountered challenges, yes. But to say that I've failed at any point, I would be lying. I think I've pretty much excelled or overcome many of the challenges that I've faced over time. I think the only failure, I can't really think of anything that I would recognize as failure. But I can recognize a lot of things as challenges that I've had to contend with and overcome. And sometimes you think of those challenges as pivots, whether it's lifestyle, whether it's personal, whether it's career, whether it's friendships and networking. I would think of them as pivots.
Right.
Yeah.
And in your view, what is one of those non-obvious skill sets that you possess that has helped you to succeed? You know, people list all sorts of stuff and it's like, run of the mill, and everybody does it. Everybody knows that. But what's something that's non-obvious as far as you go?
I think it's something that comes naturally, and that's just being conscientious. Being conscientious, being human.
Right.
And recognizing that human relations underpin everything else that this world is all about, and that human relations, if properly harnessed, are the ones that deliver the kinds of results that you you want.
So right.
Being conscientious and recognizing social networking
right.
as the critical factor in progress is a really, really important trait. And what that has done is that it's put me in a space where I have respect for everyone. I don't care what you do. I don't care if you're the janitor. I don't care if you're a CEO. If you're a human being, I'm going to treat you with the same level of respect.
Yeah.
And I recognize that I may be an important ally to an individual, but
right.
I also seek out networking
right.
because that's really crucial. Yeah. Yeah. And talking about networking, there's an interesting book. It's called Never Eat Alone, which really talks about, and I recommend that, which really talks about networking as essential, critical factor in not just our interactions, but also in our goal achievements,
right.
so to speak.
Right. Yeah. I'll definitely look out for that. Never eat alone.
Never eat alone.
Yeah.
Since lunchtime,
yeah.
always look for somebody to have lunch
Someone,
with.
Yeah.
You always share that moment with an individual and talk about things that will help advance you to the next stage.
Yeah, no, because the sum total of our lives will never be able to go through what the next person has gone through.
Absolutely.
But the lessons that you glean from being able to live your life vicariously through them.
Absolutely.
And their experiences enriches you.
Absolutely.
That makes you a more well-rounded individual for the next person that you interact with.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. And it's actually, I think it resonates also with our African culture. I mean, how many Africans sit down and eat by themselves?
No, it's taboo.
We always eat as a community.
Exactly.
And, yeah, but no, now, intentionally recognizing that, oh, wait a minute, there's actually a substantial utility in recognizing that you aren't supposed to eat alone. It's not just about sharing food, but also recognizing that there are critical interactions and insights that you will glean from that setup where you sit with people around food, and there's something about it that just helps people bring down their guards and share moments and information.
Right. There we go. And if a young person approached you and said, hey, I've been inspired by what you've done in the public sector and I want to venture in there and be of service to my country, what honest and filtered advice would you give them?
First of all, I would say to find out who they are themselves. It's not, 'cause public service, I mean, from my stint so far, is that it's beyond you as an individual, but it requires you to know who you are in order for you to fully give yourself. So first you need to identify what your strengths, what your talents
are,
and whether or not you want to deploy this particular unique set of capabilities to serve others. So once you've identified that, you can find out for yourself who you really are.
Right.
And use that for public service, and that's the best way. So, for example, I recognize that I'm pretty good at numbers. I'm good at critical thinking.
Right.
But I also need to be in my best self in order for me to use those talents in a way that, that helps. So, you know, I've always been an individual who's been into health and fitness, so to speak.
We know. I can tell stories about this.
Into health and fitness. Like, sometimes I say, I think that's my true passion, just really just being healthy and fit. Because I recognize also that there's, you know, there's utility in being optimal yourself in order for you to, to fully give to others. You've got to be selfish in order for you to be selfless, because you cannot be selfless if you're not optimal yourself. You know, I sometimes have dreams of retiring on the Zambezi and building up a nice state-of-the-art gym there, and people can come and recharge.
Oh, wow. I do that fitness component. It's still strong.
Absolutely.
Now, what most people don't know is, we've had a couple of sessions many moons ago.
Yes,
indeed. And you brought me to a stage where I realized how old I really was. I don't know if you recall this, but there was a session where we worked out and I could feel myself getting woozy. And it was like, hey, I'm just going to get some rest in the car. You'll be fine. And you came to check on me. So are you still into fitness? Like, absolutely. Are you going as hard as you have been?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still at it. I've actually built a routine around that. And so those people conversant with me in terms of, you know, checking out my socials,
whether
Instagram, Facebook, or my WhatsApp, they'll see that I'm always talking about a 4 a.m. club, because I get up at 4 a.m. Immediately I start working out. I get the office pretty early and I'll do my 5K walk before my day starts.
Oh, wow.
So that's the only time that I have that I can fully control myself before the day starts. And the rest of the time is for service. It's for the government. It's for the public.
Right.
But I've got to take care of myself first, and fitness will come first.
And aside from fitness, what else do you do to decompress? I know you have a high pressure job and there's so many demands, but when you take off the job, aside from fitness, what else is your go-to play?
Friendships, hanging out with friends, finding time to meet up with very close friends, and just having a laugh and just talking about nonsense. Sometimes just being away from that routine. So friendships, family, that helps to decompress as well. Travel, whether it's local or international, that helps to break the routine, and to remind you that, hey, wait a minute, you know, you're part of the system.
Yes.
You know, you're part of the system. You're also a consumer. You're not just a policy implementer. So that helps to, you know, to stay grounded.
I hear you. And with regards to family, what is the one thing that is a non-negotiable ritual for family?
Duty and responsibility. Always have to make time for family. After all, when all is said and done, you go back home. So duty and responsibility to family is non-negotiable. Family comes, you know, first, as they say. But obviously, the president reminded us, says you're married now to the rest of the country.
Yes.
So you have to recognize that. But yeah, I mean, balancing that out with everything else is essential in this whole matrix.
So many years from now, when people talk about you, what is the one thing you would want them to remember about you?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, but like, you know, he came, he saw, he conquered.
Wow. Straight out of the Jay-Z playbook.
I think it's just that, you know, he's an individual like everybody else, grew up average middle-class Zambian household, and found himself and deployed his talents to serve a greater cause beyond himself. But to this, I credit the networks, like the shoulders of giants that we stood on, that have given us the opportunity to be where we are today. So all due respect to that.
So on occasion, I know you managed to get some time off. What does a perfect day off look like in the life of Gabriel?
It will still start off with a workout.
At 4?
It will start off with a workout.
Will it still be at 4 o'clock?
Unlikely at 4 o'clock.
Okay.
I will probably say I will sleep in an extra 2 hours.
Right.
Maybe I'll start at 6 o'clock.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'll start off the workout or a walk or something, but just something to just get the blood running.
Right.
And then I will try as much as possible to do something away from routine.
Right.
And to be intentional.
Right.
So if my routine required me to attend meetings, I'll try not to attend any meetings.
No meetings for the day off.
No yeah. day off. No meetings for the day. If it's going to be a meeting, then it'll be just anything social and not meeting people because they want something from me. I just want to meet friends that, you know, we won't talk about nonsense with.
You need those. You can't always be that critical thinker.
Absolutely. Just wander and just do things that are away from the daily routine. Just maybe go out to eat in a different restaurant from the one that I always go out to, or just do something very different. Maybe meet new people or take a walk in a place that normally I wouldn't take a walk and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And what guilty pleasures do you enjoy that really lifts your spirits? And we've heard people tell us, oh, it's for me, it's 90s Zambian music. That's like the space. And some people amaze us and say, no, I cook, and that's me, that's my happy space. What is your guilty pleasure? What do you have that's tucked away that you don't do regularly?
So this is something that's recently acquired guilty pleasure, and that's getting on my motorbike.
You're riding now.
Yes. I enjoy the freedom that comes with just being on a bike. I mean, I think if you've heard Michael Jordan, I know you're a fan of
big time.
Fan of Michael Jordan yourself. I've been, you know, being in the trade yourself. He says something about motorbikes. Says if you've never been on a motorbike and gone on high speed and recognize the discipline that it takes
to
keep yourself on two wheels on high speed and awareness of environment, and you never really understand that. So I really enjoy the fresh air that comes with it, the responsibility that it takes to stay on those two wheels, and the awareness of the environment.
Yeah.
So you're not just taking care of yourself, you're taking care of everybody else. But also it teaches you to anticipate. In other words, bear in mind, it's almost like we, you know, defensive driving, a lot worse with motorbikes, because any mishap on the thing could be fatal.
True.
So you have to anticipate and assume that everybody else in front of you is going to make a mistake, and you have to be ready to veer off any harm or danger.
Right.
So that's a guilty pleasure.
That heightened
stage. My wife
stage.
Doesn't approve.
No, most wives don't.
She doesn't approve of my motorbike pleasure, so to speak. But it's something that, like I say, it's a guilty pleasure because I indulge against the people that that love me. And
yeah, but that's the thing with some of these guilty pleasures, like riding a bike. There's something about what it does for you, the adrenaline.
Absolutely.
You're in a state where everything's in slow motion and you see everything in 360, 8K, and it comes at you, and it's so different, and it's a feeling that you can't explain to anyone else.
Absolutely, unless they've been on a bike.
They've got to experience it themselves, and like, oh, so this is what it's about. Unless, of course, they get terrified and then never want to come anywhere near it again. As we conclude, obviously, you were at the helm of some major policy with regards to dealing with the drought that hit Zambia. And you're continuing to help formulate policy. Beyond policy, when we look back and say, ah, Dr. Gabriel Pollan, what will we remember?
I think it's one of the things that you pointed out on the introductory part, where you talked about being a key resource in the drought response, the 2024 drought response. One of the key things I remember at that time was a presidential directive to say, no one would die of hunger. And how I interpreted that was, I would do everything in my might to ensure that the presidential directive is implemented. But beyond implementation of the directive is also the human face of the people who were facing deficits. And, you know, we traveled by chopper to do assessments, to land in very remote parts of the country.
Right.
And to actually look at people in the eyes and say, well, we'll do everything that we can to ensure that you have the food that is needed.
Right.
So having been in that space, it just felt so honorable.
Mm.
Yeah, and quite a humbling experience to have been a critical resource within the you know, within the context of a drought that hit the country in that way.
Good. Now we saw the images. I mean, you put away the fitted suits and you were in the work suits and the jumbo, the boots came on. And there was one picture that really comes to mind vividly. You were basically straddling two trucks, almost like Jean-Claude Van Damme. I was like, okay, this is interesting.
Absolutely.
Now, but that work speaks volumes about being available for the public sector. And for that, on behalf of Zambian people, I'd like to say thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
It's been absolutely wonderful chatting with you. Grateful for you sparing time out of your really busy schedule to be on Nkwazi Unfiltered. And thank you for letting us peek into some of your more private moments. And now we have a better sense of what makes you actually tick. And when we see you, like, aha, it's that drive again. Now we understand. But thank you so much. We're really, really grateful to have had you here. It's always a pleasure to run into you. And thank you so much for staying true to who you are.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much for
having
me. Thanks.
Thank you so very much for watching yet another episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered. As always, our guest today is a man who has marked success. He's been doing so much for the country, for academia, and he's an inspiration to a lot of people. His name is Dr. Gabriel Pollen, and he's currently serving as the Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Local Government and Rural Development. His accomplishments speak for themselves, but today we've got a chance to know the man behind the legend. Be sure to tune in the very next episode of Nkwazi Unfiltered, and who knows, you might just be our next interesting guest.